Mohammed Hassan is an award-winning journalist and poet. You may have listened to the podcast he made 1 year after the Christchurch terror attacks called The Guest House, and earlier Public Enemy, which won a Gold Award at New York Radio Awards. He was born in Egypt. He was raised in New Zealand. He's been working as a journalist for digital news agency Middle East Eye in London, most recently back here for a holiday. Lockdown happened, and now here he is. Is that right? You got stuck?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I've had to tell the story so many times, but essentially, I mean, I'm kind of in a self-imposed exile. There's worse places to be stuck in the world right now.
I think there probably are, including London.
Most definitely including London.
You've got a new collection of poetry out called National Anthem, mm-hmm. and you have appearances coming up at Verb Wellington and Word in Christchurch. Details on our webpage. Congratulations on the book. Is this what you have been spending your time doing while in lockdown-ish?
Yes, a lot of it has to do with... I think I was very grateful to be stuck here as opposed to stuck in London while I'm working on a book, so I can meet up with the publisher. I can spend a lot more time doing edits and back and forth and finalizing basically, you know, the mad rush to try and get the last of the poems and to try and figure out what the structure is going to be, what it's going to look like, find an illustrator to work with, and all of that was so much easier being here and being able to kind of have the mental capacity to work on it.
Do you see a clear difference? I mean, it's a stupid question. I'm full of stupid questions this morning, though. Do you see a clear difference between being a journalist and being a poet? Because a lot of your poetry is quite journalistic, right?
I think so. I think a lot of it is kind of documenting my experiences and the experiences of others around me and kind of personifying it. It's a tricky line to have to try and straddle, and most of the time I'm trying to figure out exactly where I sit, because journalism teaches you to be very objective, to be very detached. Not that I necessarily agree with that kind of old school journalism always. And poetry is about, you know, personifying a lot of these things and about tapping into your own emotions. And sometimes, you know, in the case of a lot of the stuff that I write, being very opinionated and saying things the way that you feel they should be said. And I think it also speaks to my identity over the last 20 years as a Muslim under the global war on terror and the post 9/11, where it's hard to separate who I am as a Muhammad from who I am as a Muslim, as a political identity, and both those things kind of clash into each other. So even as a journalist, a lot of the stuff that I did was cover my community and cover issues that were very personal to me that I thought was very important, and I had to fight for them as a result. And I see my poetry as kind of an extension of that, but maybe with a lot less strings attached.
And also, while you are trying to remain or maintain some semblance of detachment while a journalist, you can let it out in your poetry. So it must enable some kind of internal balance for you?
I think so. I think in the best of times, it is kind of a balance. In the worst of times, sometimes I feel like they're warring against each other, where I have to try and sometimes police what I'm trying to say in my poetry because I'm worried that I'm going to cross that threshold and say things that I might not feel comfortable saying as a journalist, but that I feel very strongly about saying as a poet. And I think I've gotten a lot more comfortable with that over time, especially as I figured out what my journalism means to me and what it should entail.
I know you we've asked you to read a couple of poems, and one of them is Unlearning My Name, and this is a kind of a pillar poem for your book, because a lot of the things expressed in it run through it. Can you talk me through what Unlearning My Name means to you?
Absolutely. So this is a poem basically about me going on a journey to try and pronounce my name properly, the way that it's supposed to be intended, instead of trying to anglicize it so that it's easier for other people to pronounce.
And it's not even that hard, right?
It's not that hard, but but again, I mean, like I think a lot of people hear me say this poem and then they feel the pressure to say the name that, you know, the way that I say it, and I tell them that that's not what the poem is about. The poem is about how I say it, how I internalize my name, and, you know, in turn, how that relates to how I internalize my own identity and how I see myself, and how I see myself in you know, in foreign spaces and in spaces that maybe aren't as familiar or as comfortable with who I am. And I think journalism played a big part of that because, you know, when you do a radio story, as I did, you know, many times when I was working here at RNZ, you sign off with your name. And for a long time, I was signing off with my name anglicized until, you know, one of my colleagues, Shannon Hanui Thompson, if she doesn't mind me giving her a shout out, she really pressed me on it. She's like, she came to me one day and she asked me, is that how you pronounce your name? And I'm like, well, you know, not really, but that's how it's done. And then she basically made me promise that I was going to go into the booth and say my name the way it's supposed to be pronounced. And I didn't. And it took me a very long time. And she kept pressing me. And eventually when I did it, it was kind of like this breakthrough moment for me where I felt like I suddenly became comfortable with a part of myself that I struggled to become comfortable with in the past.
Let's hear the poem.
Okay. Mohammed. 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 The first time I am mistaken for a white man, I feel a rush of joy lurching from my gut. A relief. I have finally won a place today. A right to belong, an invisibility, if only for a moment. I am asked what my name is, and I flinch. The jig is up. I am caught in a lie. Mohammed. The familiarity fades. A little flicker behind the eyes is not lit for me anymore. The third stage of grief is bargaining. But you look so much like us. You don't look Arab at all. Where do you get your blue eyes from? They are so beautiful. It must be somewhere in your bloodline. We must be. This beautiful. Which parts of your ancestry do you owe us? Which parts have you stolen? Mohammed. I have spent my life carving vowels out of my throat so my name will be easier to say. Sanding down my grandfather so I could fit him in a carry-on bag, a driver's license, a job interview. Mohammed, the praised one. The one thanked in the earth and sky. I am pouring oil into my throat until it lines my stomach, until no guttural could ever escape. I still say it the way my first white teacher said it. The way she corrected me in front of the whole class until I learned how to stumble over my identity the way she did. To strip away parts of myself that couldn't be marketed to a Western tongue. I still shave off my curly hair and wear blue to bring out my eyes. So beautiful. Where did they? Mohammed. 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 It takes me 19 years to learn how to pronounce my own name in public. The first time I say it, the way my mother did when she named me, Muhammad, it feels like I have stolen something back.
That's Muhammad Hassan. It's the best I can do.
That's pretty good.
With his poem, Unlearning My Name, from his new book, National Anthem. That's a lovely line, sanding down my grandfather so I could fit him in a carry-on bag.
It's quite an abrasive image, isn't it?
Yeah. What were you thinking then?
Well, in a very simple term, I'm named after my grandfather. My grandfather on my dad's side is called Muhammad. That's what it was named me after. And it kind of, when I think about it, it's kind of a betrayal of him. For me to kind of change my name or to mispronounce it in a way that I think is strategic for my own maybe survival or a sense of, you know, belonging. Mm. But I think it's about the parts of us that, you know, as immigrants, we bargain on a daily basis, which parts we choose to show, which parts we choose to hide in order to try and attain a sense of place in a society that isn't always as comforting or as welcoming as we'd like.
How many views has your presentation of that poem had online?
On Twitter, it's hit 1 million, which is insane.
Good grief.
It's crazy. I had no idea that this was going to happen, but I think it was overnight. It just blew up, and then my phone was just going mad with notifications and messages, and it was happening from all parts of the world, even parts that I did not expect. Like, people were sharing it and sharing stories about their own names and writing their own names, and I had a lot of teachers messaging me saying that they were showing that poem to their children and that it was changing the way they were thinking about, you know, the spaces that they were creating for their kids that in their classrooms. It was pretty incredible. Like, it really kind of took on a life of its own that then had nothing to do with me, but it was just about this conversation that I think a lot of people wanted to have and then started having.
I mean, we sneer a lot at social media, and there is indeed a lot of stupidity on it, but that is not one of them. It's a way that you can say the world is a better place as a consequence of social media, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's one of the things, it's a real testament to what poetry can do, because when I wrote this poem, it was a very personal poem. It was something that I was writing very specifically about my own experience, and I put it out there because I wanted to share my experience with people. And what I found out was that this experience was extremely universal, in ways that I didn't even understand. Like, there were people that weren't immigrants, that had lived in countries that they, had long lineages to, and yet still had these issues about people mispronouncing their names. And it seems like a really small thing, but I think to everybody that has kind of faced any kind of, whether you're trying to change your name or you having to correct people a lot, and then eventually you just start changing the way that you say your name to make it easier for people, it means a lot. It means a lot to people to kind of finally think about what that actually means to them.
You thought you were writing something very personal. It turned out to be surprisingly universal. That's what they often say. That's not what they say about poetry specifically,
yeah,
that the more personal you get, the more universal it turns out to be.
Absolutely. The specificity is the universality of it.
Mm. You did Public Enemy, which is the podcast that you won the New York Radio Awards with, Gold. And it was about Islamophobia, violence and discrimination against Muslims. And, of course, after the Christchurch attacks, you must have thought you were prescient.
That's the funny thing. I mean, it only seems like that from outside the Muslim community, but I think a lot of people in the community were not. I mean, I think the way that I describe it is that,
I mean, it's 2017, I should make clear. So
that podcast was created on the 15th anniversary of the September 11 attacks, uh-huh, and it was looking at counterterrorism and counterinsurgency and Islamophobia here in Australia and the US, and kind of looking at people's firsthand experiences. And the New Zealand episode had a lot to do with what the NZSIS was doing, the security agency,
or not doing,
but you know, the intense focus and scrutiny that was on the Muslim community, people's mosques being monitored, people being stopped at airports and things like that. And so when this attack happened, especially after, you know, there's a lot of people in the community that have been talking about the rise of hate crimes, the need for hate crimes to be recorded by the police, the need for, you know, the government agencies to really start focusing on the rise of far right and the rise of, you know, Islamophobic speech and tendencies. And so when this attack happened, people were obviously all shocked. Were we surprised that it happened? Not as much.
Yeah. And what you said was, what you said most recently in a piece, we cannot be done talking about Christchurch. We cannot remain unchanged by it. Do you worry about that? That it was a horrible thing, and we dealt with it with an outpouring of grief and support for the most part, and now we've moved on.
Yes, I worry about that a lot, actually. And I think the response that we saw in those weeks after the attack were beautiful, and they were exactly what was needed. But I think what was meant to happen after that, for our sake as a country, is to really kind of have a soul-searching conversation about how this event of historic proportions is going to change us as a country. And I think if it doesn't change us as a country, if we kind of move on and pretend like maybe it was something that was very foreign to us, which I know is a lot of people's, you know, like outlook on it, that would be a missed opportunity to really change this country for something that is more beautiful than it is. And to have really difficult conversations that I think we often struggle to do in this country. We don't, you know, a lot of difficult conversations, whether it's mental health, whether it's, you know, domestic violence, whether it's racism, we struggle to talk about them.
Do we?
I think we do. I think there is...
I mean, who are you comparing us to? I mean, I think we're blabbing all over the place about all sorts of things now.
I feel like we are now. I feel like we're starting to have those conversations. But those conversations aren't easy. They're difficult. I had colleagues of mine from the Muslim community that spoke out about racism and about Islamophobia in New Zealand. And, you know, in the first 2 weeks, people left them alone. But then after those 2 weeks, after Christchurch passed, they started getting death threats. They started getting personal messages. They started getting the comments on, you know, in the Herald section returned. You know, the infamous don't read the comments, but the ghost comments returned, and those people exist, and they
were
threats.
Stupid people.
I mean, they're stupid people, but they represent a section of our society.
But do we have to take any notice of them? I mean, are they dangerous? Are they just stupid people that under normal circumstances would be sitting in a dark corner of their room eating instant noodles?
Well, I think the reality of what we're seeing happening in the world today, what's happening in the US, what's happening across all of Europe.
They all join hands, those stupid people, and
yeah.
Turn out to be...
And I mean, the Christchurch shooter, you know, had documented links to a lot of foreign organizations overseas. And so these things are happening. There are people in this country, you know, there was, you know, just a few weeks ago, there was somebody that was appeared in court again for breaching for bail conditions and going near the mosque that he had threatened in the past before. Mm. You know, when you talk to groups like the Islamic Women's Council, the members of that council are still getting threats. They're still getting concerns. They're very concerned about the kinds of correspondence that people are sending them. And these are real people. And
I
think if we ignore them and if we don't do real soul searching, I think we...
I know, but it's so difficult, isn't it? Because they... I mean,
it is difficult. It's not a fun conversation to have.
For the purposes of this conversation, I'm extending the definition of insanity to include people such as the person that you referred to earlier. So, how much should we expend on people like that?
I think it's not so much the extreme cases that we should be looking at. I think it's the cases of the ordinary conversations, the things that happen behind closed doors, the kind of conversations that I, as an immigrant, as somebody who's brown and a Muslim, I'm not privy to. And I think this is the kind of thing where people from my community can begin these conversations, can call for these conversations to happen. But really, we're talking about these conversations to happen between Pākehā New Zealanders. We have to have a conversation about white supremacy. White supremacy has a long root in this country, as it does in a lot of other, you know, settler colonial states, and that those things are hard to shake. And when they're ignored, it leads to what we saw happen in Christchurch. It leads to what we saw happen in other countries, and that is still happening. You know, these far-right attacks against Muslim groups, against immigrant groups, against Jewish groups, they haven't ended. The shock that the world's experience when the Christchurch attack happened, that did not assuage, it didn't really stop or stem the kinds of attacks that were happening. And, you know, it emboldened some pockets that maybe were quiet before, maybe were ignored before, but now felt emboldened. They felt they had a voice.
One of the episodes in your podcast, The Guest House, dealt with the effort some of the survivors of the Christchurch mosque attack had to make not to be angry.
Yeah.
And one said, it was Guled Meyer, I think.
Yeah, Guled.
He said he had to make sure that he did not fit into the angry black man stereotype. I can't imagine how difficult that is to constantly monitor yourself so that I'm a woman. I mean, of course I understand that, but this is more than that. That to constantly monitor yourself so that you do not allow people to pigeonhole you into a stereotype and write you off.
Yeah, I think there's
Or be afraid of you.
Or be afraid of you. And I think for Guled, it's compounded. It's him being a refugee, it's him being a Muslim, and it's him being black. All of those things kind of carry connotations with them, and they carry things that he has to fight every day by just being himself. And the fact that he chooses to be a Muslim advocate and that he chooses to speak on behalf of our communities makes him a lightning rod for a lot of these things. I think the interesting thing that I noticed and other people noticed after Christchurch is that there was a reluctance, a hesitation for people to share their anger. And if people were angry, of course they were angry, you know, legitimately. All of us were angry. But there is something about being a Muslim over the last 20 years in that our identities have essentially been very visible, very under a spotlight constantly. Who we are, our mosques, our culture, our beliefs have been politicized. And as a result, we've learned to have this knee-jerk reaction where we apologize.
We have been politicized.
We have been politicized.
Not only by non-Muslim, but also by some sections of the Muslim society. Right?
Absolutely. And this is kind of like the war on terror that we've kind of been experiencing has created this identity of a Muslim, which is a political identity, which was not the case before. You know, it's being a Muslim is my belief system, but suddenly it became who I was. It became who I was at airports. It became who I was when I was speaking on television. It became who I was when I'm applying for immigration status. All of those things kind of factored in. And as a result, we tended to be very apologetic for our existence. Whenever an attack happened, whenever ISIS did something, immediately we felt this intense pressure and expectation to go out and to apologize, to be very apologetic for what's happening, which was extremely unfair. Mm. But it also meant that we were very careful about how we were perceived in the public. And after Christchurch, that feeling didn't go away. And it was very counterintuitive, but I think there was an instinct on behalf of a lot of people to be very gracious and to be very thankful and to be very forgiving. And all of those things were true. People felt those things, but they also felt anger. But we had to quiet the anger. We couldn't be seen to be acting, you know, ungrateful or rocking the boat.
Because you're refugees, right?
Yeah, refugees,
you should be grateful.
Immigrants, absolutely. And that's kind of the overwhelming narrative that not just Muslims, but all kind of refugees and immigrants have to face in some way or another. And I think it's definitely a wider conversation because I see it happening to Maori all the time. You know, Taika Waititi called this country racist and he got a massive backlash against it. People were railing against him. People wanted him stripped of his titles and stripped of New Zealander of the Year, even though this is somebody who is, you know, indigenous to this country and is speaking from his mind.
No, that's quite right. We can talk a lot of stuff directed outwards, but we can't take criticism of things that we hold dear, like, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not sexist, I'm not. But what are we?
And I think we make a mistake when we personalize this conversation. You know, to say that racism exists in this country, to say that there are racial structures that exist in this country, is it not a personal conversation? It's not about individuals, but we are all a part of the system, myself included, and we have to have a conversation about how to pull apart these things. And that starts with having very uncomfortable conversations. It starts with looking in the mirror and soul searching and maybe, you know, admitting to ourselves first and foremost that those things do affect us, whether we like it or not. Mm. And that's the first step.
Did the Christchurch terror attacks change you?
I think it changed me fundamentally in ways that in a lot of ways I probably don't understand yet. I think I'm still, like a lot of people in the community, still really processing it. I think like a lot of people in this country are still processing it. One thing that has changed in me that I recognize is the need. You know, I spent a long time in this country growing up feeling like I don't quite belong and waiting for a moment in time when I felt like people, you know, gave me that belonging. You know, they said, you know, I went to a citizenship ceremony and I got given a citizenship. And I think I was waiting for that day where somebody gave me something that made me feel like I belonged. And after Christchurch, I realized that belonging is kind of an act of resistance. It's a verb. It's a doing thing. And that nobody's going to give me a sense of belonging, that I have to enact it myself. That the only way that I'm going to feel like I belong in this country is that if I act like I belong and if I make it something that I do every day. And part of that is, you know, being brave enough to have conversations in public and say things in public that I mean that maybe I was trying to be polite about or hide. And that is part of what it is to be a citizen, what it is to be a New Zealander, is to
How
be able to engage.
How will sticking your head above the parapet help you feel like you belong? I mean, the conventional wisdom would be just blend in.
Well, I mean, that is the conventional wisdom of immigrants, you know. And to a large extent, you know, my parents' generation, they came here and their struggle was survival. They've come to a foreign country. They have families to feed. Their driving factor is just to kind of keep their heads down and not to be noticed. And what my experience is growing up as a Muslim after 9/11 is that I can't help but be noticed. My identity precedes me everywhere I go. And so this idea that I'm going to keep my head down and people are going to treat me better off for it is not true. And we saw what happened last year. And that was a community that was keeping its head down. That was a community that was being as invisible as possible. And yet they were sought out and they were in a lot of ways they were made an example of because of their identity. And that taught me that that strategy does not work and it doesn't benefit me. And if I'm going to be visible anyway, I might as well be visible on my own terms.
The other poem that you've chosen to read is called When They Ask You Where You're Really From.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a good lead into that.
Yeah.
When they ask you where you're really from, tell them. Tell them you are an unrequited pilgrim. Two parallel lives that never touch. A whisper or a window to what your country could be if only it opened its arms and took you whole. Tell them about the moon, how she eats at your skin, watches you pray and fast and cry while the world sleeps, how she gives birth to herself and dies and you wish upon her children, how you wander her night, plant cardamom in your friends' eyes, cumin in their teeth, za'atar on their brow, lick the rest off your fingertips. It tastes of visa on entry, heaven with no random checks. Around the iftar table, everyone speaks of politics and God, trans rights and colonialism, but we forget that we didn't speak the empire's tongue once. So when they ask you why you speak so well for an immigrant, tell them about your grandmother's laugh, how you never quite knew whether she was story or myth, the upper lip in your conviction or a song ringing in your bones, drifting in through the kitchen window with the fried shrimp and the newspaper voodoo dolls. Tell them how you have always been a voodoo doll, your feet licking the flames, the stovetop eye, a television screen, a news bulletin, an open casket, the needle pushing and pulling through your skin, every puncture, a question played by an accusation, every bullet hole, an answer you have to fill with silence, with religion, with Xanax and daytime television. And when the muezzin calls you to pray on the radio, you will wrap your limbs in cotton sheets, walk through the crowd with your hands in your mouth, waiting for the gun.
Whoa. How are you feeling these days?
Ooh, that's a heavy, loaded question to be asking in 2020.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a lot of things. I'm grateful to be back in New Zealand this year. I think I spent a lot of time outside it, and it was difficult trying to kind of deal with Christchurch.
You were in Turkey when it actually happened, then you came back, right?
That's right. I was actually flown back that night, and I spent the next 2 weeks in Christchurch, which was a relief for me to be surrounded by my community at that time. And this year, of course, COVID has kind of messed up everything because I came back to cover the first anniversary of Christchurch, which was the ceremony itself was canceled because of COVID restrictions. I was meant to be flying down to cover the sentencing hearing, and I couldn't because Auckland went into lockdown, and so I had to cover it remotely. By myself sitting at home, which was quite overwhelming. It was a very, very intense week. But it was something that I think was necessary.
It have been less overwhelming had you been able to be there?
I think it may have been just as overwhelming, but I think there will be something different about being surrounded by
something
people.
Something more cathartic about it than absolutely sitting on your own watching it.
And I mean, I saw the videos of what happened, you know, on that Thursday afternoon after the sentencing that was handed down, and those survivors, those families walked out to celebration, to people singing in the streets.
You wanted to be there.
Of course I wanted to be there. But I was overjoyed watching that happen, because they walked out of that courtroom like heroes with their heads held high. Which was very different, you know, to what had happened, you know, in the beginning of the week when people walked in and they looked afraid and they looked uncertain. And what that transformation looked like over that course of the week was pretty incredible.
Lots of text saying, you know, fantastic poems and thank you very much. And this one from Chris, who says, they had to pull over to make a comment, so they deserve to be read. While I agree that the Christchurch shootings must be responded to by better dialogue, it would be wrong to suggest that it is or was New Zealand culture that in any way led to the event. The Australian that committed the crime moved to New Zealand, chose New Zealand, because it was vulnerable owing to the peacefulness of our environment. We were targeted because culturally we were the safest place, and we still are. Do you think that that's true?
I think in a lot of ways it is true when you compare New Zealand to our neighbours in Australia and how intense that racism is, how obsessed people are over there with Muslims who make up 2% of the country. When you look at the US in terms of their politics, and you look at a lot of countries in Europe, that's definitely true. I don't think that quite necessarily takes us completely off the hook. I think it would be a mistake if we, sure, he was Australian and he had come to New Zealand with a specific agenda, but he also was training at a gun range in Dunedin where, there were people that were at that gun range that were worried about not just one person, but several people. There was a lot of sympathizers in this country. There were people that were charged for threatening mosques. I think people don't remember what happened after 9/11, but a lot of mosques in this country were vandalized. A lot of people have been attacked. A lot of women have had their headscarves ripped off on buses. This is happening in this country, and this has continued to happen. And to some extent, this still happens even after Christchurch. There have been people threatened in the streets. You know, the Imam Gamal Fouda of Al Noor Mosque was walking through the streets last week, and he was racially abused in public.
I know. And my first inclination is to say, you know, another insane person. But somebody's taken me to task for that. I'm just trying to find the text which says to describe people who perpetuate racism as insane, which I did earlier, because I'm just a blabbermouth, fails to recognise that much of it is ignorance of other. And we need to ensure that people get the chance to see the other as worthy of care, compassion, and effort to get names right. That seems willfully Pollyanna-ish to me, that text. I mean, we need to ensure that people get the chance to see the other as worthy of care. I mean, this goes back to how you present, right? You can't be too angry or ungrateful, because then people might not like you.
Yeah.
Do you know
absolutely.
What I mean?
Yeah.
So how would you present as worthy of care? Well, I mean, that's not how to combat racism.
Well, I mean, in an actual genuinely egalitarian society, it shouldn't matter how you present yourself to be worthy of care. And that's the thing. That's the kind of pitfall that a lot of immigrants find themselves in that they are expected to be exemplary figures. They are only celebrated in society when they go above and beyond, when they do extraordinary things. And then they become worthy of, you know, what has been bestowed upon them, which is this opportunity, this citizenship. But that's not what citizenship is supposed to mean.
No.
Citizenship is supposed to be unconditional. Belonging is supposed to be unconditional.
I was talking to Judith Butler earlier about something completely different, but her latest book is called The Force of Nonviolence. And in it, she argues for a new way of living called radical equality. which she says affirms social and ecological interdependence, radical equality, because she says that inevitably now we see some people as less deserving of care, less equal than others. That's a fact. We do. And somebody, Barbara, has just texted me to say that she's just voted in the mosque and she feels that that was an important place for her to exercise that democratic right.
That's beautiful.
That's beautiful, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, mosques are supposed to be community centers. They're not supposed to be just places of worship. They're places where things happen. You know, the earliest universities in the world were essentially mosques, you know, in Egypt and in Morocco. And that's supposed to be the function of those Islamic centers.
Yeah. Very nice to talk to you. Best of luck with the book and your career. You're going to continue to be a journalist and a poet, I take it?
Absolutely.
You're not going to give up one of the day jobs?
I don't think I could if I tried.
No. Lovely to talk to you, Mohammed Hassan. And you can hear him in Christchurch and Wellington at the festivals. Verb in Wellington and Word in Christchurch. All the details of that are on our website. He's in the City Gallery in Wellington this afternoon as well, this very afternoon. What time?
2 p.m.
2 p.m. Very good. Thank you. Before you go, I have never had an interview move me to tears before, but this one has. Mohammed's comments on belonging being a verb resonate so deeply with me as a Pākehā living in stolen land. And the truth is, New Zealand is racist. We might not be as racist as XYZ countries, but that does not excuse us. Thank you.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.